FRC's funding drive is now underway. Join us at the Upper Hall of the Spire on Saturday, November.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will focus on Canadian media. In the interview I will play during the show, we will learn more about the rules and standards that Canadian media should theoretically follow. And if they don't, we will see what are the accountability mechanisms there are in Canada for the media, and do they actually work? We will also hear many examples of Canadian media failing when it comes to coverage of Palestine-Israel, and also talk about the bullying campaigns that people who criticize the Israeli government face as soon as they speak out. We will hear about who are the main organizations that lead these bullying, intimidating campaigns against Canadians. Stay tuned.
This is the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. We discuss all things related to Palestine and examine how they intersect with the political landscape here in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. This episode of the Palestine Debrief podcast is a conversation with my colleague here at CJPME, Jason Tony. We talk about Canadian media ethics and CJPME's Media Accountability Project, which we refer to as the MAP. The MAP is an initiative of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and was created to encourage Canadian media to provide professional and fair-minded coverage on the Middle East, especially Palestine-Israel. The work of the MAP is based on professionally recognized journalistic ethics as established by the Canadian Association of Journalists, CAJ, and the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council, which direct journalists at all levels to provide accurate, fair, independent, transparent, and diverse coverage. Jason is a director of media advocacy in CJPME. He's also a writer and a publisher. Jason, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Sam. Glad to be here.
Let's take it at the top. Jason, explain to us, what is media accountability?
Yeah, on a basic level, media accountability is the idea that journalists should place ethics and standards above their own ego. If a mistake is made, it should be corrected, and that correction should be transparent, you know, accompanied by an editor's note. But essentially, journalism in at least Western media is supposed to serve the public good and allegedly democracy. And if that is to be fulfilled, it's very important to respond to the concerns that are raised by the public and remaining accountable to the public, who are the ones that this news is being produced for, so they can stay informed. As we'll see, media accountability is much more of an idea than it is something that's practiced by most media outlets. But in principle, that's what media accountability is supposed to be.
Because otherwise it's propaganda.
Yes.
So tell us about the fundamental principles and political importance of the MAP.
CJPME's Media Accountability Project was created in about 2023, early 2023, in order to fill a void in advocacy around Canadian coverage of Palestine and related issues in the region. But essentially, there was no meaningful institutionalized effort in order to advocate for better coverage of Palestine and Palestinians. And so CJPME developed this project and hopes to bring professional and fair-minded recommendations to journalists and editors and different media outlets in order to help resolve some of the well-documented slant that exists in coverage of Palestine in Canada. As it stands, there is a lot of data to support the reality that Palestinians are not treated fairly in the media. Organizations like The Breach have done excellent research in the past year or so on this issue, bringing some of this to light using advanced tools in natural language processing in order to take large data sets and provide evidence for what I think most people who are involved in Palestine solidarity work have noticed over time. But the Media Accountability Project essentially serves to hold journalists and editors to account when they're violating basic ethics and standards that they're supposed to be bound to, because they tend to ignore those standards when it comes to Palestine. Some people have called this the Palestine exception. And I think there's a lot of evidence, a growing body of evidence, that the Palestine exception is very real. It is proven, and there's a lot of work to do in order to change the course of coverage of Palestine in Canada. And the Media Accountability Project is really just about getting that work started and off the ground. And as we'll discuss, we've had some successes, but we've also demonstrated the real limits to media accountability in Canada.
It's only about Palestine, though. I mean, certainly we'll focus on it during this talk, but I think it's a broader element to all coverage that's non-white. But I mean, I think, and if you look at all Western media coverage, if it for all elements, I mean, I remember during the World Cup is a very good example, what happened in Qatar during the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, anything that's non-white, and I put, you know, speech marks on that, there's always that bias in its coverage. I mean, it's a symptom of a much larger issue.
Yeah, I think different groups that face varying degrees of oppression, some of them have managed to break through, so to speak, whether it's Indigenous people or people of color. There have been moments of reckoning, so to speak, in newsrooms around Canada on how to report on those groups, where progress has been made, albeit limited progress, I think, in most cases. But the way things are reported now on certain issues do tend to be different than they used to. And the goal is for Palestine and the way it's presented in Canadian media to have its moment of reckoning.
And even in terms of the progress on that, is it the way that I also saw it is that the progress has always been in a commercial way rather than it's actually a change in bias. And the couple of examples that come to mind is like the Netflix documentary on, you know, the Indigenous oil and gas sector. What's it called? Yinta. And then there is the documentary as well on Colin Kaepernick. So, I mean, that's not a change in perspective or a change in attitude on how news is presented as much as it's just commercialization of it. So, does that classify as a success?
I think because Western media tends to be corporate environment, one driven by not the needs of the public, but of the needs of advertisers and capitalism, when we see progress, it often is happening within the matrix of greed. And as a result, some of the changes could be described as sort of just minor or aesthetic, but not getting at the root of the issues. But that said, I do think there's great value to hearing from, let's say, unpopular voices, at least unpopular for the Western media class and the ruling class who tends to dominate the media space. And what we're seeing now is an increase in the number of Palestinians who are even being able to give comment on these stories, going back to the context of Israel-Palestine. There was a time where Palestinians wouldn't be interviewed, their narratives would not be included at all. Now, one of the problems that we have right now is there's a sort of prejudice to where those viewpoints are included in articles. When we do see Palestinian voices in traditional media, they tend to come towards the end of an article, or when they're on broadcast media, be it TV and radio, it's usually just presenting them as a sort of helpless victim, but not actually presenting Palestinians in the spirit of their resistance. So there's still certainly issues, but I do think that's one area where we see some progress being made. And I do think it's meaningful that more Canadians and people in the West in general are being exposed to these narratives in a way that they just weren't even before. And I think that extends also to like Indigenous groups, which have, I think, I don't have data on this, but my sense is that they've been able to get more media coverage and be able to speak more in the sort of traditional media landscape.
All right. So what are the media ethics and standards?
Yeah, the media ethics and standards that journalists are expected to follow in Canada are laid out by a few different groups. One would be the Canadian Association of Journalists, the CAJ. The CBC has their own journalistic standards and practices that they treat as a living document that gets updated that you can view on their website. For broadcast media, there is the Canadian Broadcasting Standards Council, which not only lays out what the ethics and standards are that are supposed to be followed, but they also deal with complaints about issues that listeners or viewers notice on television or radio. When it comes to newspapers, print and online media, there's the National News Media Council, which is similar to the one I just mentioned for radio and television, where newspapers join this council, and if readers have a complaint, they bring it to the council, and that National News Media Council will arbitrate the issue. But all of these groups, I just laid out four different groups, all of them publicly promote different media ethics and standards. They're functionally the same with very minor differences, but the ethics and standards in Canada are centered around the idea of balance, fairness, diversity, independence, transparency, and accountability. Now, those things they overlap quite a bit. They can be defined in different ways, but fundamentally the idea is that coverage should be balanced. It should seek to get a fair portrait of whatever the issue is, and we should hear from different groups that have a stake in that issue. Now, there is false balance, which is the idea, for example, if you're covering climate change, that having a climate denier and treating them the same way as a climate scientist is an issue. So the idea of balance is not just you interview anyone who has a stake in something. You're supposed to present fairly the relative value of somebody's perspective and give readers a sense of where that perspective is coming from. Diversity and independence is really about having a plurality of voices, but not allowing one's coverage to be dictated by the needs of a corporation or some private political interest or anything of that sort. And transparency and accountability is really just about making changes when they're appropriate and being clear when that happens. And also making clear who, when somebody's writing, you know, what are their possible conflicts of interest and avoiding them having any, but if there's anything possible, it should be disclosed to the reader, even if they're a columnist writing an opinion article or whatever it may be. So this is kind of in general what media ethics and standards in Canada are. And this tends to be the case for most Western journalism, these vague ideas around these core principles. The issue is that in some cases, these principles are followed, and in other cases, in certain contexts, they tend to be abided by less.
Yeah, that's a thought that came to mind. I mean, standards exist in a certain context, of course. They are very theoretical, but on the ground and in practice, a certain context takes precedent.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think of it is that the standards are written in such a way that they're strong enough to be compelling and popular, right? There's a reason they've gained such widespread usage, but at the same time, they're vague enough to be easily discarded if ever an media outlet prefers to just avoid controversy or serve the interests of the ruling class, right? They're malleable. They're written in such a way that they can be twisted to their needs. So it's very hard on that accountability point to actually make an argument based on these ethics and have that stand up to a newsroom where they'll actually make a change.
Yeah. There are many examples of media personalities. And I'm, again, like, I don't have any Canadian specific examples, but maybe you can help me with that. But there are people who's lost jobs for opinions and perspectives and positions that they've taken. The one that comes to mind is Mark Lamont Hill with CNN, but I'm sure there are tons of other ones. And then, you know, the question is to, you know, you're talking about media ethics and you're talking about standards, and you have someone who's ultimately presenting perspectives that are in line with international law. As far as I know, that nobody really is taking any radical positions, but they'd have job offers revoked or taken off air. And then that question, where are your ethics and standards on that? Because on the other end, and specifically on the Palestinian advocacy example, you have people on air saying things that are, you know, like there's the example that happened last week with, I don't know what his name is, and I'm good that I don't know his name, and I hope that I won't know his name. But when he told Mehdi Hassan, "I hope your beeper doesn't go off," on air, on CNN, and, you know, he apologized and he won't be invited again. But, you know, that's how far it will go.
Yeah, to me, with what you brought up, what comes to mind is these ideas of objectivity or impartiality, right? We treat journalists as if it's possible for them to be objective or impartial, but their opinions bleed through in so many ways other than clearly stating their opinion, right? The way articles are framed, where certain perspectives are placed, where active language shows up, like Hamas kills Israelis, versus where passive voice pops up. An example would be Palestinians have died in a war, right? There's a clear difference in those two ways of framing things. And yet we see overwhelmingly that passive, neutral sort of descriptions are given of Palestinian deaths, whereas very emotive, active language is used for Israeli deaths. And that's supported by data, right? I'm not just inventing that. These are the ways in which journalists and editors are able to really change the narrative around things while abiding by all of their standards as far as they're concerned. But really, I think that shows how weak the standards are and how inescapable having opinion come into things is. It's just about, you know, do you want to allow opinion to trickle in these ways in support of oppressed peoples or, you know, on the side of dominating forces of the powerful? So, yeah, I think we have to get away from the idea. And I do think, you know, there is a movement away from this idea that it's possible to be objective at all. And that doesn't mean we toss all the ethics out the window, but these subtle ways of framing stories are extremely important for journalists and newsrooms to take seriously and very important for the public to be aware of when they're reading these stories. These are the subtle tools that media uses to prop up a certain narrative that suits the purposes of those who control the media.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, all this is in line with a much bigger playing field. I mean, certainly journalism is a part of media, but, I mean, this anti-Palestinian sentiment is, you know, Netflix now is pulling their Palestinian content off the platform. Before October 7th, we've had, you know, Loki's music and Muhammad Assaf's music taken off Spotify. I mean, there is an intentional suppression of Palestinian voices and Palestinian content across all media. And then the Media Accountability Project that we're working on and we're doing is just a subset of that. And I think it's very limited on how far it can go, but it's work that definitely needs to be done.
But I'll just say, I think it's worth the fight, right? Because through doing this work, we've been exposing how desperately we need to overhaul the systems of accountability for media in Canada, and how desperately we need independent media to step in and do this important reporting that's just being overlooked by traditional media.
So let's take it down into the practicals of the work that you do. How do you decide on what issues or news to target?
Yeah, there's no exact formula for how we decide to advocate. It's really just the result of doing this work for a couple of years now and having some good examples. You know, I think the work of the map is inspired by some of the writing of like Noam Chomsky, for example, who's done great work on propaganda systems and how they operate and ways that ordinary people can fight against propaganda. But fundamentally, it's just a matter of every single day, you know, five days a week, reviewing the media related to Palestine in Canada. And we have tools for doing that. So we review the media and we just keep our eye out for things that we find particularly problematic or, on the other hand, work that's good. And we try to express our appreciation to journalists when there's things that sort of break from the common issues that we see. And we try to support those journalists because they're usually the ones who have a target under their back. Like doing good work on Palestine is something that will get you in trouble. So we write letters of concern. We have staff and volunteers who write letters to the journalists and their editors and producers, making arguments based on these well-established professional journalistic ethics and standards, which we've identified some issues with, but nonetheless, that's an important tool that we use to do our advocacy work. We're not bullying people into giving a type of coverage that we prefer. We're using well-established ethics to go ahead and make the case for improved coverage on the different issues that we see. And it really follows the news cycle. So when October 7th happened, that obviously kicked things into overdrive. And since October 7th, there have been 5,000 different topics that have been at the top of the media at different moments related to different things, whether it's protests in Canada, the situation on the ground with the genocide in Gaza, whether it's Israeli protests going on. There are so many different things that have come up, and we have to review that and come up with what we think are the primary issues that need to be challenged. And we've had a significant amount of success in certain issue areas, and we've even seen in general some improved reporting from specific media outlets that's carried over through time, be it improved reporting when they're talking about death tolls, seeing more active voice, getting Palestinians to be quoted higher up in articles. Things of that nature have become more common. And it's not strictly because of us. I think there's a grassroots movement going on in Canada right now where a lot of people are doing this work on their own. And hopefully we're serving as some kind of a guide and providing some leadership. But certainly, I don't think that at this point we're the only ones doing this. But we've managed to institutionalize it and have systems in place for selecting what to target. But it's not necessarily formulaic, and we have to always be sort of reinventing how we do things and rethinking our approach and changing our strategy. You know, we used to, and we continue to put out a lot of alerts. We alert people to coverage and ask them to write in so we can get hundreds or thousands of people to write in to media outlets on their own, presenting their own ideas. All we're doing is saying, look, this deserves a response. If you want to do it, here's how. But that's the methodology that we use in general.
Okay, and you monitor newspapers, broadcasts, radio shows. I think even you started monitoring podcasts, if I'm not mistaken. And then there's even the generic websites that list information. Like I think there was one about the geographical website a while back that you wrote to.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a whole variety of media that we're looking at. Quite often, the things that we'll respond to actually come from our supporters who have identified a particular issue that they want our help in responding to. But certainly, it's a lot of different types of media. But primarily, we do try to hold media outlets to account that are members of these standards councils, whether it's for TV, radio, or newspapers. That's not to say we ignore ones that aren't members. We still do try to have an impact, but we have found that our impact is a bit more significant if we can actually use these media councils that take complaints and submit the complaints through a formal process. That does tend to be a helpful tool, even if it's not working as well as it should.
And usually how long does it take for a response or an update?
Yeah,
you do get ignored a lot, I assume, as well.
Yeah, so if we get ignored and the particular news outlet is not a member of any kind of accountability council that takes formal complaints, there's very little we can do other than publicize the issue, right, and sort of shame them in public. But if they're not a member of the National News Media Council or the CBSC, the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council, then there's nothing we can really do. But if they're a member of one of these councils and they try to ignore us, we can file a formal complaint. Now, the problem is that when you file these formal complaints, quite often they're just rejected out of hand for seemingly arbitrary reasons that I firmly disagree with. But if they are entertained, if the complaint is entertained, it's up to the news outlet to make a change before going through the extended formal process. And typically they don't want to make a change, right? For whatever reason, media does not like making changes and taking accountability and putting in editor's notes, etc. So then you end up in this very elongated process that can take months and months and months in order to resolve. So for example, my colleague Anthony Issa recently did a TikTok video that's on our social media that you can watch, talking about the experience of filing a complaint about a radio segment with a pro-Israel advocate named Dahlia Kurtz. And in this interview, Dahlia Kurtz said all kinds of terribly racist things about Palestinians, like objectively inappropriate comments for radio, as well as repeating numerous false claims about encampments at McGill and things of that nature. CJPME made a complaint with the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. The radio station did not initially want to make any kind of change. 4 months later, the CBSC told this radio station that they should make a public apology and clarify that Dahlia Kurtz was making comments that weren't based on fact, even though she was claiming they were facts, like Nakba denial. So in the end, we did get the radio station to apologize, and that is significant in its own way because it's almost unheard of. It rarely, if ever, happens, especially on talk radio when they're interviewing somebody like this. But 4 months later, I mean, I'm sure none of the regular listeners of this radio station even remembered this particular interview if they happened to be tuned in this really pitiful, you know, 3-sentence long apology that was aired. Now, that said, I think it's significant. I think this is the kind of thing that embarrasses producers and that they should feel some shame about. But the fact that it takes so long is a huge problem because the damage is already done, right? This stuff shouldn't be happening in the first place. But this is the current situation. We have many more examples like this, where when we do get a change, it often takes months and months and months. CJPME and the Media Accountability Project have developed strategies to try to expedite that process by just being extremely persistent, by threatening to go to councils, but trying to resolve it outside of that space because it is so inefficient. But ultimately, it's really a grassroots effort from the public giving flack, as Chomsky has called it, this idea of giving feedback, usually negative feedback, to media when they do these kinds of things and just making clear it's unacceptable. And, you know, sometimes that involves getting advertisers to pull out, things of that nature, which what we've done in the past, we've convinced advertisers to stop advertising on certain websites that are promoting false narratives around Palestinians and things of that nature. But yeah, this is a really good example, I think, of the hard limits of media accountability and just how desperate we are for a kind of change to how these things operate.
Because the example that I recall, I remember that I was my input was asked for that. It was the CBC translation of the Arabic word sabaya. which means, you know, the girls or the women. And they translated it as Sabaya. And even their understanding of the word Sabaya, which means female prisoner, they translated it as women who can get pregnant. What happened is 4 months later, 5 months later, maybe even it was longer. Do you remember how long was it?
It was around that time, man. It was months later.
Yeah. They updated on the website the translation. And, you know, what came to mind is, you know, as we say in Arabic, and I think it works in English as well, you know, who hit has already hit and who ran has already ran. Like, the damage is already done. You know, nobody's looking at these videos anymore or talking about them anymore. And, you know, opinions has already been set and cast. I mean, is it possible that if enough of these apologies happen and enough of these changes and updates occur, is it possible that eventually when the time that the actual article is written or translation is being made or, you know, radio shows being aired, that on the back of their mind, they're thinking, we don't want to apologize about this 6 months later. Let's fix it up on the onset. I think that's what we ultimately want to get to. If enough pressure is put and enough letters are sent and enough apologies are issued, that now it's top of mind.
On our end, we've tried to develop relationships with the different newsrooms to just get them to make the changes much faster so we don't have to go through these long processes. The example you gave is a really interesting one, so I'll speak a little bit more about what happened. But Israel released a video of female soldiers who were taken as prisoner of war by Palestinian resistance fighters around October 7th, and this video was released with this horrible mistranslation that was suggesting that basically the Palestinians were committing war crimes just based on their comments around these women, saying they're women who could get pregnant, et cetera, as you described. But really, that's not at all what the Palestinians in the video were saying. The fighters were saying something very different. And we had at CJPME a number of our Arabic speakers confirm this. And we went back and forth with CBC for months before CBC finally backed down, because at first they were standing by the translation, but months later they finally backed down and put a little editor's note under the video clarifying that the translation had never been properly verified and there was controversy around it to sort of distance themselves from it. But fundamentally what that video was is it was propaganda. It was propaganda released by Israel in order to create a certain image of Palestinian fighters to further this idea that Palestinians are all of these negative things. You know, Western media has described them as rapists, as terrorists, etc. And certainly there seem to have been war crimes committed on that day, but this was an effort to just manufacture one out of thin air where it didn't seem to belong at all. And I'm not trying to provide like a specific justification of that situation, but fundamentally a change should have been made immediately to that translation. The translation should have been very suspect when it came to CBC, as it was being spread around to different media outlets. But CBC, they took it seriously. They put it out there. It did an enormous amount of damage, and much later they had to apologize. But the issue, I've referenced Chomsky quite a few times, but he says that I'm probably paraphrasing, but it's something like propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to the totalitarian state, right? This sort of thing is not a small issue of translation. This is a part of a huge propaganda effort to convince Canadians to not oppose genocide. And what we're seeing today is a very significant number of young people in Canada are opposing genocide, but an older generation that's been fed this propaganda for decades is much more hesitant to stand up against apartheid and genocide and occupation, etc., despite all of the evidence that we have that these things are real and they're happening and we need to do something, even in our limited capacity here in Canada. But yeah, I think that example that you brought up with Sam demonstrates the issues again very well.
And just to show you as well that I pay attention. I don't play all the time. What organizations are supposed to support journalists when they come under attack from pro-Israel lobby, and what are they doing?
Yeah, so the pro-Israel lobby in Canada, which consists of a number of groups with names, but in this case, on the media front, it's primarily Honest Reporting Canada, which is a pro-Israel media advocacy organization. They are essentially there to defend Israel no matter what in Canadian media, and they use bullying tactics in order to convince journalists or editors to change their articles. They are fundamentally a pretty far-right Zionist group. They don't believe in calling the West Bank, much less even calling it occupied. They want to call it Judea and Samaria, and they argue that Canadian journalists should do that. They have all kinds of very far-right, pro-settler kind of opinions that are publicly available on their website. And they bully journalists and harass them and launch campaigns against them. And they tend to especially focus on women of color and repeatedly target them in their articles and the good work that they're doing. And it's a very unfortunate situation that's been going on for years. But public documents show that Honest Reporting Canada has had a huge increase in their budget, especially since October 7th, and their resources are expanding, and they're trying to create other ways of intimidating not just journalists, but even activists away from doing Palestine solidarity work. They want a Canadian canary mission, so basically a blacklist of Palestine activists that's intended to scare people away from doing pro-Palestinian related work. But essentially, you have this well-funded organization that's there specifically to bully journalists out of doing fair coverage of Palestine. And there are organizations that are supposed to support those journalists in Canada. One of them is the Canadian Association of Journalists, the CAJ, which is one of the groups that promotes Canadian journalistic standards and ethics, but they're also supposed to be an organization that supports journalists when they face unfair working conditions, attacks, etc. And what we have seen, unfortunately, is the Canadian Association of Journalists has done extremely little to support journalists when they come under attack. That said, a recent article in The Maple described the situation with the CAJ and their inaction and essentially called them out for not doing enough for Palestinian journalists. And in the past, the time of recording this podcast, in the past couple of weeks, the CAJ has suddenly been more active supporting Palestinian journalists or people on the Palestine beat. So it does seem there may be some kind of change coming there, but we need to see these institutions step up more to do their part in supporting journalists who are just trying to give Palestine a fair shake. Beyond that, JSource, which is another media organization here in Canada, has created the Canadian Press Freedom Project, which I believe is canadianpressfreedom.ca, where they're actually inviting journalists who have been harassed by Honest Reporting Canada to submit their stories in an effort to take some potential action down the road against Honest Reporting Canada for their bullying tactics that are being used against journalists. And then we also have the Just Peace Advocates, who are actually challenging Honest Reporting Canada's charitable status. They're not a nonprofit, they're a charity in Canada, and they're challenging right now their charitable status with the CRA. So there's potential changes coming down the road in that way. So I do want to make very clear that the Media Accountability Project from CJPME is not at all inspired by Honest Reporting Canada. We do not at all view our work as similar to theirs. We base our work on media ethics and standards in Canada, even if we have criticisms of those standards. But we do our best to promote fair coverage of Palestine, whereas I think there's every bit of evidence that Honest Reporting Canada does not care about media ethics or standards at all. Their goal is to support Israel at any and all costs, be damned with any kind of ethics or standards. And I think that's well evidenced by everything that you can see on their public website.
Yeah, we don't bully.
we try to be fair. We try to, you know, just promote good and fair coverage where we try to avoid using bullying language or unfair language. You know, we try to avoid accusations of bias and things of that nature, because those tend to just burn bridges and not be particularly useful in changing narratives. Now, that's not to say that we can't be very serious and persistent and firm. Certainly we do that as well. But our interest is not in producing an environment of fear, but trying to inspire people to do better work on this. And we're seeing, I think, quite a bit of success on that.
You know, the bullying is unrelenting, right? I can give one specific example, which is Zahra Al-Akhras. She got fired from Global a while back for posting pro-Palestinian, pro-resistance sentiments on her personal Instagram page. And it's been a year, and since her firing, Honest Reporting is still posting about her. Mm-hmm. I mean, one that happened last week, they follow her personal social media and they are still posting that, you know, Zahra Al-Akhras is posting pro-Palestinian content on her personal social media. It's not like they achieved their objective of getting her fired, but they're still targeting her now.
Yeah. Yeah, they're trying to manufacture a situation where people are afraid to do this work. Another example is there's an immigration lawyer in Canada who was targeted by HRC, not a journalist, but they still targeted him. And they used a professional photo of him that they had. And in sort of an effort to troll them, this lawyer thanked them for using such a nice photo of him. In response, Honest Reporting Canada sent out the information again, but this time they showed him topless in an effort to humiliate him. And I am not a journalist, right? I'm a media advocate, but even doing this media advocacy work, I've been targeted, not to make this about me, but I've been targeted with relentless hate, whether it comes on social media or to my personal email. I'm being doxxed by columnists at the Toronto Sun for the work that I'm doing, just trying to tell them to correct their errors when they happen. You know, so all I'm asking for is some basic accountability, and they're attacking me in these harsh ways. So it's unimaginable what journalists, especially people of color and vulnerable groups, are facing when they're doing this work. The Canadian Association of Journalists, one of the reasons they stood up for a journalist is because she was being doxxed after these relentless attacks she's been facing from pro-Israel groups. She's being doxxed and they're sharing information about the business that she's a part of and trying to convince people to go there, seemingly to intimidate her. So yeah, there's really endless examples of all of this stuff crossing the line.
Yeah, the attacks that you get are very weird as well.
Yeah.
It's very homophobic. I mean, what?
Yeah.
But then the other question that comes to mind, and this is in line with what you said about the attacks that came, and is that many of these reporters, that we're not targeting them personally, right? We're requesting that certain journalistic standards that are in line with, you know, the organizations that you mentioned in the beginning be taken into consideration when reporting the news. There's no personal attacks. There's no doxing. There's just a formal request. But on their end, they're not taking it in any shape or form seriously. One of them, I don't know his name, and I'm glad that I don't know his name. He prints out the letters, frames them, and sticks them on a wall in his office. And he posts about it on social media that, you know, they sent me a letter that's a badge of honor sort of thing. Because that's the sort of thing that we face. We're professionally requesting journalists to take into consideration, you know, standards. On one front, the media ethic councils respond to us 6 months later. And on the other front, the journalists themselves mock us. I mean, what's the word that we can use?
Yeah, mock
and then
a good
they
word.
Attack us.
Yeah, mock is
yeah,
the
they,
word.
I mean, they mock us and then they attack us. And then we're following the standard that you put. We're not coming up with anything from our end. There's no agenda. Like we also get labeled as a front for Hamas and a front for Iran. What are you talking about? We're using the standard that you put.
Yeah. We're using widely held Western media standards to make critiques of coverage. And yeah, the example you gave of one columnist slash journalist at Toronto Sun literally taking the letters we write, which are well-researched, carefully written, reviewed, he frames them and puts them on the wall and usually doesn't respond to us and then jokes about it on social media. I mean, all we're asking from people is for them to do their jobs. And part of their job is listening to feedback and being accountable when people are right. And what's embarrassing for them is there have been a significant number of times where we've gotten them to change things. They're not transparent about it. They usually make subtle, quiet changes and don't put an editor's note as they're supposed to. Occasionally they do. But the reality is that we're asking just for the bare bones basics, and the response is to try to mock and just create an environment of fear and intimidation to sort of scare us out of doing this work or use our work to promote a certain narrative that they're already trying to promote in their work. I mean, yeah, it's frustrating. It's frustrating, but it's...
Yeah, his ignoring of our letters is very loud. His silence on them, yeah. You know, printing them out.
Yeah.
Framing them and then sticking them on his wall, but he's ignoring us.
Yes. Yeah. 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 It's nice to live rent free, literally on the walls of these pro-Israel journalists who don't respect media ethics and standards. It's fun in its own way.
Yeah, imagine the time and effort and finances that he has to print the letter, take it to the framer, pay for it, bring it back, hang it on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, I know.
Yeah, they're nice frames too. They don't look like Walmart frames. They're nice.
Yeah. Very flattering. So in addition to the examples that we gave, the TikTok that Anthony made for the Dalia Kurtz radio segment, and we also talked about the CBC mistranslation that they corrected. What other strings of impacts have we had recently?
So the map has been on a bit of a roll lately, let's say. We've had a huge number of impacts as of late, and I think part of it is we've just really figured out the best methods for getting changes, and we've really figured out what to target and what we can change. So to give some examples, first of all, if you want to see examples, you can go to CJPME Maps website, cjpmemap.ca, and we have an impact page where you can look at all of the different impacts we've had. But even in the last couple of months, we got Radio Canada, which is the French version of CBC, to change the category label that they use for all news about the Middle East. So any story about Palestine, but in general stories about the Middle East, were framed as they literally had it. It was the Middle East, the eternal conflict, but in French. And we felt this was terribly unfair because that means every single time a reader opens a story from Radio Canada, they're being presented with the idea that this is an eternal conflict, that this has been going on for thousands of years. All kinds of other things are likely to pop in your head, like this is a religious conflict, etc. And I think people who are listening to this podcast and generally interested in this kind of work understand that's totally ahistorical and unfair. And so we led a campaign with media responders. You can sign up again on our website to get our alerts. But we had hundreds of people write and complain to Radio Canada about this issue. And they actually, after about a month or two of consistent advocacy on our part and in collaboration with Alex Tyrell, we got them to change it. And now it's just still imperfect, but it's just the Middle East conflict. But if you open a story on your telephone, it used to say in huge letters at the top of the story about this, the eternal conflict. So we think that's pretty significant that we got, after persistent effort, CBC to or Radio Canada to change this issue. So that's one important one. So that's kind of a bigger media outlet. On the smaller end, so we're targeting all different scales. There's a newspaper called Aurelia Matters. It might be Aurelia Matters. It's a small newspaper, but they had run a letter to the editor that was full of anti-Palestinian racism and claims that were just demonstrably false. And we had a number of our responders and some of our staff complain about this. And the newspaper actually responded that it didn't meet their editorial standards, that it was published as a mistake, and they decided to take it down. And that's another example of demonstrated success. Although we tend to be against unpublishing as a practice, I think it's very dangerous for media to get in the habit of unpublishing content, taking content down when they've made a mistake. I don't think that's a good solution. But in this case, the outlet did say it was put there. It being put there was a mistake to begin with. So I think it's an exceptional situation. We also convinced the Hill Times to remove the language of an Israeli counteroffensive from one of their articles. They had framed Israel's attacks in Lebanon as a counteroffensive, and we felt that was terribly inappropriate to suggest that Israel's actions were somehow a retaliation, when in fact these things have been, you know, going on for quite a long time, the attacks on Lebanon that Israel has been carrying out. And it was really misleading to readers. And the Hill Times agreed to remove the language of counteroffensive and to be more careful around using language of response or retaliation, which is so often done, which presents Israel as always defending itself and Palestinians or Lebanese or anyone else in the region as being the aggressor, which we feel there's tons of evidence to show that that's just not fair. And usually it's quite the opposite, or just much more complicated, and it should not be presented in that way. So that's an example of something that we've been fighting. There are quite a few more changes that we've had in the last couple of months alone that are really significant, but I'd invite anyone who's interested in seeing our impact and really understanding the value of this work that we're doing, because I do think there is distinct value and it's worth supporting this effort. You can go on our website and check out those impacts. And I think most people will be really impressed. I mean, we're getting positive feedback from all corners of Canada, you know, celebrating the work that we're doing. And now even internationally, people are starting to notice, and there's interest in using our methods to establish media accountability projects elsewhere in the world to do this same kind of work, to challenge these narratives, to get media to give Palestine a fair shake.
Do you think that, is it possible to really have anywhere in the world an example, or, you know, as close as possible to truly objective media without agendas?
Look, I think the reality is that there's no such thing as truly objective media. That doesn't mean we should throw standards and ethics out the window, but I do think it means that corporate media, that corporate owned media, or media that serves the powerful and is run by the powerful, is a very dangerous model. And I think some of the best media today is done by independent media organizations that still value ethics and standards and are accountable, but aren't owned by the powerful, that are actually supported by the public, that are donor-based, that are covering stories that are otherwise overlooked. I think those types of media outlets are totally essential. In Canada, we have some great news outlets like The Breach or The Maple, and there's a number of others that I could name, but I'll just name those two because we've worked with them quite a bit and I've been impressed by the work that they've done. But they're really, in my mind, leading the way on this stuff. And I think they're continuing on the path that's been carved out by many outlets that have come before them. I mean, if you're in the US and you're listening to this, you know, I think you'd be familiar with Democracy Now, who have done so much to raise the voices of oppressed people around the world, but also especially in the US. And they've always been at the forefront of coverage on Palestine in terms of a Western media organization covering these things. So I think that's very important, to take money and corporations and private interests as much as possible out of media. I think that's really essential. We have a situation in Canada right now where a huge percentage of newspapers in Canada are owned by one corporation, Post Media, which is owned by a hedge fund, right? And Post Media has an extremely clear pro-Israel bias that is very easy to demonstrate through data, but also just looking at it, you can see how biased and slanted it is against Palestine. But even the media accountability institutions we have in Canada become dominated by these corporations. 20% of the members of the National News Media Council, the Ethics Council in Canada, 20% of the newspapers that are members of that are owned by Post Media, owned by this massive corporate media corporation that is owned by a hedge fund. And the National News Media Council has, as members of its board or professional members, editors from Post Media, right? So this is a huge issue. I mean, getting money out of politics is spoken about all the time, but I also think it's essential to get money and power. We have to release media from the domination of the ruling class and have media be supported and for the public in a really true grassroots way. I think that's the way forward.
What does the future of media accountability look like in Canada? What do you think needs to change?
Yeah.
And do you think the work that we do plays a part in changing the narrative?
Yeah, I think we are actively playing a part in not only changing the narrative and holding media to account. You know, we've had a significant impact through our thousands of letters that we've sent out in the last couple of years. But we've also, I think, and there's enough evidence of this, we've inspired journalists to be courageous and to do their job and to not back down because of fear from their imposed by their employer or the fear that's the result of these pro-Israel advocacy groups trying to intimidate them. I think that's hugely important. I think we need to figure out ways to overhaul the media accountability systems that we have, because I think they take too long. They tend to be dominated by these, you know, private interest groups, essentially these corporations, and they're not serving the Canadian public. And I don't have all the answers on exactly what needs to change, but it's clear the current system does not work at all. It is slow. It is arbitrary. It is maddening. And there's just too few people who are responsible for holding the media to account. And the few people that there are, in my view, are not doing a very good job. So things need to change. I do think the more people that do this kind of work, not just CJPME, but ordinary people who contribute towards challenging these narratives and holding media to account, the closer we're going to get to changing these things. But fundamentally, I mean, I think this is a trickle-down impact effect of just the problems that capitalism imposes on media coverage in Western societies. And I think there are systemic issues that need to be changed in order for us to get anywhere. So support your local book publishers, support your local media outlets, donate to them, and write to your local journalists and tell them when they're doing a bad job and complain to the media ethics councils if they're refusing to change anything.
Thank you for tuning into the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of CJPME and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network.
That's it for the hour. On today's show, we focus on Canadian media. What are the standards they should follow, and are there ways to hold them accountable when they don't? Among other things, we also learned about the many organizations that lead bullying campaigns targeting critics of the Israeli government in Canada. If you missed part of the show, you can go to Security's website and listen to it again. All shows are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find us. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free Palestine.